whenever you're broadcasting live from New York, there's always that temptation to say live from New York, unless you're actually a broadcaster from New York, in which case you probably don't feel that temptation. But I'm visiting. This is Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast. I'm in the fabulous studios of Premier Radio Network and enjoying the terrific help of Edrice Johnson. Thank you, Edrice, for doing the board work tonight. Jason back at the studio, Gina as well. I'm here for a bunch of different reasons, some of which have to do with the book that I wrote, the children's book, which is being bought at a rate faster than I can keep up with them right now. So we're trying to change that by either making the book less popular or to have more of them available. We're not sure which way to go. We were thinking, let's make Dizzy the Mutt with the Propeller Butt less popular, and then we don't have a problem. Or we can find a way to increase distribution. So that's topic A for this trip to New York. And topic B is Comic-Con. The New York Comic-Con is going on. And that's just, you know, this is along with the one that's in a couple of the ones that are in California. This is really the big one. Huge, you know, list of celebrities here. And it's neat because, you know, you come here for Comic-Con, you get to see Nancy and Sluggo, Beetle Bailey. You get to see, you know, no, I'm kidding. It is just all the latest cutting edge comics, the best of the animated movies that are coming out. They're getting previews this weekend. Lots of celebrities, many of whom have been on Coast to Coast before, like Stan Lee. He's going to be there tomorrow at the Comic-Con, I believe. David Mack, my friend David Mack, and Will Eisner. Well, actually, Will Eisner won't be there, but there's a new movie about him coming up. So I look forward to catching that tomorrow in a special press preview of that. And Will Eisner has never been on Coast to Coast, although I'd like to think he's been on C2C in spirit, if you know what I mean. But tonight's going to be a big show. Coming up later on, we'll go to open lines, the back half of the show. But before that, some very challenging questions. The book is called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. And it addresses the complex relationship that we as human beings have with animals. We like to think that it all makes sense, but it really doesn't. Well, or maybe it does. That's what Hal Herzog, Dr. Hal Herzog, has been working on for many years. How to understand the complex relationship between animals and humans. Why is it that there are some we love, some we hate, and some we eat? Is there a consistent criteria for why? And what does that really ultimately reveal about ourselves? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, my only regret in the book, Some We Love, Some We Hate, and Some We Eat, is that I didn't have a chance to finish it because it's just terrific. Really well written, sparkling book, great conversation starter. Good evening, Hal Herzog. Dr. Herzog is a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University, lives in the Great Smoky Mountains, and a very good writer. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, I can now. Thank you so much. You know, in the back flap of almost of any book that that I would have in my collection, there'd be the obligatory author photo in the woods with an Irish setter or a golden lab, and you're in the woods, but you're holding a— is that a chicken under your arm?
That is indeed a chicken. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, explain. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with having a chicken under your arm, but it's not what you would expect when you're flipping open the back cover of a book.
Well, actually, I got into the study of human-animal interactions because of chickens a long time ago.
Well, let's use that other word, too, anthrozoology. That's a great word. And it's a discipline which apparently has been going on for a long time. Some people call it the human-animal relationships, but anthrozoology, that's sort of the field in which you are a specialist, correct?
Yeah, it goes back about 30 years, and it's real interdisciplinary. It's part psychology, part sociology, part history, part animal science, part ethology. But it, basically what we all have in common is we're studying the complex relationships that people have with all the different types of animals in our lives.
Well, and therefore chickens. So how was it that originally chickens became your door into anthrozoology?
Yeah, that's a good question. When my wife and I moved to the country, we moved to Western North Carolina about 30 years ago, I found out that some of my neighbors were cockfighters. And they seemed like awfully nice people, but they had this one little thing in their life. You know, they would go out Saturday night and they would fight roosters to the death. And they were, you know, they went to church, they were conservative, they raised families, they were very nice. And I just could not figure that out. And at some point they invited me to go to a rooster fight with them. And I wound up writing my doctoral dissertation on cockfighting. And what I was primarily interested in was how these folks construct sort of a moral framework that makes sense. And I realized at some point that their justification for fighting chickens wasn't that much different than my justification for eating them. And that set me on a path that's really been going on for close to 30 years now about trying to make sense of all the ways that, you know, the crazy ways people think about animals, including myself.
Well, there's another anecdote that you tell on yourself in the book about when you were accused of feeding kittens to boa constrictors, something you would never do, something you found horrible, but somebody that you had been friendly with called you and asked you to address this rumor that was going around. Was it going around the university, or was it going around where? Who was talking about this?
I live in really a small town, you know, deep in the mountains, and it was going amongst the person that called was actually an animal rights activist who's a friend of mine, and she told me that some of her friends had heard that I was getting kittens at the local animal shelter to feed my son's boa constrictor. And I, you know, my son did have a small baby boa constrictor, could never eat a kitten. And I was just horrified at the idea. And I told her, no, that's certainly not true. And I don't know how that rumor got started. But then I started thinking about it. And I thought, you know, let's just run, you know, let's just as a thought experiment, sort of work out the ethics on this. And what would be better? You know, there's a couple million, you know, cats killed in animal quote shelters each year in the United States. Shouldn't we feed their dead bodies to the pet snakes of Americans rather than breeding animals like rats and mice just for that purpose? And I realized how inconsistent my own thinking was, especially since a lot of people the person that accused me of feeding kittens to boa constrictors, she had cats herself, and her cats went out and killed little things out in the woods every day.
Meaning the cat did or the person did?
No, the cat did.
The cat did. The cat would eat birds. The cat would attack squirrels. The cat would.
Absolutely. The cat. Right. The cats of America consume about a billion small little animals, you know, birds and squirrels and stuff like that
right.
each year. A lot more right. than are used in animal research.
I had a cat that I adored, who was the most docile of cat. Wasn't the fastest of foot. Never caught a bird, but was great at finding bunny nests or hutches or whatever it is.
Oh,
and just, oh, it just broke my heart every year. It was every year there was this bunny massacre. And it wasn't like we didn't have 10 million of them in the neighborhood, but it still, it speaks to your point about, you know, people can keep a cat and say that they're a cat lover or rather an animal lover. But then cats can also be responsible for a lot of, I guess we would call that collateral damage.
Damage is exactly what I call it.
Yeah.
The cats of America, you, a person might be a vegan and a vegetarian and be opposed to eating meat. But if they've got a cat, their cat's not a vegetarian, I guarantee
right.
it.
Right. Even if they try and force feed the cat to be a vegan or a vegetarian at home, it's not out in the wild.
No, that's exactly right.
Right. Some we love, some we hate, some we eat. That's Hal Herzog's book. We're talking to him here, and I know it's going to get a lot of controversial calls about this later on, but you used the word thought experiment earlier, and that's really what the whole book is. It's a series of thought experiments that challenge the way we think about our relationship to animals. And I think that it would be statistically true to say that almost all Americans would rank themselves as an animal lover.
You know, that is a great question. And I think that's generally true. I have met a few people that tell me that they're not animal lovers. But on the other hand, the vast majority of people I meet tell me that they're animal lovers.
Well, I'll put it in the reverse. I can't imagine there would be anything but a small percentage of Americans, maybe even human beings worldwide, that would rank themselves in the category of an animal hater.
That is exactly right. In fact, I've got a study going on right now where we're trying to locate some people like that and find out what that's about. Well, we're just starting it now.
You know, my wife has always been canine phobic, and she'll be the first to say out loud that she generally hates nature because it's very unpredictable. And there's something about that, the chaos that comes with you know, with various larger form organisms that she finds unnerving. And so even though she, we have a dog and she loves our dog, she's not a dog lover per se. She likes that particular dog. And when it comes to other animals, she gets really nervous around horses or cows or anything. She doesn't want anything to do with them. But I think that's so that some people, you know, that, but I think it's the rare person who falls in that category. Most people are not only accepting of their own animals, but they would do a lot to try to save the life of an animal. The question is, what will they do to save the life of an animal versus what they would do to save a member of their own species? And I like the series of thought experiments you have in your book on that.
Yeah, that's the trolley problem I think you're probably referring to. That is a situation used in neuroscience now to study how people make moral decisions in their brain. And you give people sort of a hypothetical situation where you say, there's a trolley going down the tracks, and it's headed toward, let's say, a group of endangered chimpanzees, and you can pull a switch, and you can send it, let's say, careening into a an old decrepit man. What should you do? And virtually everybody says, this has been done, worldwide, is that you should, sacrifice the chimpanzees to save the person. Even if you ask people, if it's your dog, let's say it's not chimpanzees on the track, let's say it's right. Your own dog, should you save, would you be better off saving your dog or a stranger that you don't know, a human being you don't know? What people say is that you should save the person rather than your own personal dog. But on the other hand, people are willing to pay vast amounts of money. I just paid $300 for vet bills for my cat, which, I could have sent that to Somalia.
Right.
Might have saved some people.
Right. Or even taking that $300 and giving that to a cat shelter and saved a bunch more cats.
That's exactly right. That's as opposed to one cat. That's a great point.
Right.
That's a terrific point.
But, the interesting part, too, I think the inverse of that is also fascinating for me. And again, we're talking with Hal Herzog. The book is Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. I think human beings have this anthropocentrism, or is it anthropocentrism, where we think that animals hold us in a higher regard than I think is actually true. And that comes up whenever there's stories about animals that save a human being, that chimes with our sense of our own importance at the top of the food chain. And that always kind of cracks me up.
That is such a great point. I've never really thought of it like that, but that's just a terrific point. I was actually, a little while ago, I was reading a paper that I had written quite a number of years ago, and it was a paper that I had written on how animal stories in the tabloid press. And we just found scads of stories of animals saving people, including things like stingrays, crocodiles, Bigfoot.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. There is this idea that animals, given the chance, will rescue us, that they
right.
hold us in this high esteem. Although, my cat does not hold me in particularly high esteem.
It's taking you for granted.
She tells me to open the door, and I open it for her.
Yeah. Wave that bill in her face. See if that does anything. $300 $300. Just a reminder of that. I think there's something about this, and again, in this complex psychological relationship we have with animals, it also speaks to the ones then that we not only love, but we expect will love us, which is like which is kind of like the funniest idea that animals in where they live are looking for our approval, beyond dogs or cats. That they want human beings to say, good camel. Or, there's something about that just kind of cracks me up, because I don't think most animals give a flip about us.
Well, some of them do. Some of them, look at you when they see, dinner, but there's not very many of those around anymore.
Right. Well, either because, my dog, I think my dog looks at me as like, as the top of the pack and the whole bit. But really, I'm just the food guy. I mean, I'm just the guy who can magically make food appear.
Well, that's how my cat feels about me, I'm pretty sure,
right.
too.
So, but I could never at the same time. I mean, I think of other species, like, it always cracks me up when they have a story of a dolphin that saves a swimmer.
Yes.
And there's something about that makes us feel like, there we go. A dolphin that gets it. God is in God's heaven and all things are in their place. the dolphin saved the human being, and we think that's the way it's supposed to work. And we never mind the fact that, you know, how many 100,000 other people drown every year without a dolphin in sight to come in and help them out.
Well, you're absolutely right. This also comes up with dogs, by the way. And if you, for example, if you go to, you can try this sometime. Go Google dog saves man, and you'll find a gazillion things. Well, there's actually, I described this in my book. There's actually a psychologist, Bill Roberts, who actually set up an experiment in which people were taking their dogs for a walk, and then the dog's owner actually feigned a heart attack and sort of laid down and became unconscious. And Roberts had a stooge sort of standing nearby. And the question is, would the dog actually go get the stooge and bark like Lassie would? And in no case did any dog ever do that they tested.
But except for those very well-trained rescue dogs.
Oh, yeah. That's
right? The helper dogs.
Absolutely. And that's for real. No question about it. There's absolutely amazing things that they can do. But they're trained. They're not your average pet.
Yeah. And you can't. But see, now, wouldn't it be neat if you could take a helper dog and train them to bark and run around in circles and act crazy when you're about to spend money foolishly? Wouldn't that be neat?
We now have dogs that, you know, can sense epileptic
right.
seizures and
right.
can do all this stuff.
Right.
Yes, I love that idea.
That's what I need.
Foolish money spending dog. That's a great idea.
That's where I need the help. My dog is absolutely no good to me there either. What's her? Okay. So, but you know, you mentioned the thing about dogs, but we love dogs, even though dogs are the number one threat against human beings in the United States today, correct?
Yeah, the most common fear by far in the United States that human beings have is of snakes. And if you look at the number of people that are actually killed by snakes each year, that you can count them on basically one hand. On the other hand, you are basically 100 times more likely to be killed or injured, seriously injured by your neighbor's dog than you are a snake. But yet fear of dogs is vastly lower than fear of snakes.
Well, and I've known no fewer than two women who have had to endure major facial reconstruction from their own family dogs.
Yes.
Where in one case, an older dog had just become somewhat addled and confused, and it was sleeping, and she came down on the bed to give it a little kiss and a pet on the head, and it literally ripped her face off.
Yeah.
And somebody else who suffered something just as much, but only lost use of their jaw and stuff. And that's where you look at that and you think, well, that's even from the pets we love. That's a much bigger threat. But we don't exhibit a fear of dogs in the same way that we do of snakes. And that just doesn't make any logical sense. But you argue it makes emotional sense. Why?
Yeah, I think that's right. By the way, usually it's children that have their face ripped off by dogs. It's not adults. It's actually a serious problem. And then there's the dogs that love you. For example, about 80,000 people are taken to hospital emergency rooms because they trip over their dog.
Oh, yes.
So there's lots of mayhem. But I think the problem is that it's not a problem. It's actually there's a good side to it. We basically admitted dogs and cats into our families, and they have become, they've essentially been, in the words of the pet industry, they've become humanized. I mean, I certainly humanized my cat. You know, I just paid $300 for her, plus I'm sitting here looking at her right now.
Right.
And when I was writing this book, she would come down and she would sit next to me as I was writing, and I took great comfort of that, you know, for that. And so they can play these tremendously positive roles in our lives and be great comfort, but it's a mixed bag. The dogs are the second biggest cause of conflict between neighbors.
So right there, though, isn't that why, and we'll pick this up here in just a second, that's why we love certain pets. It's not necessarily because, I'll say something controversial here maybe, but not necessarily because they deserve it any more than, say, you know, any of other God's creatures out there, but rather, they get our love because of how they validate us.
And we love them for that. Yeah, and there's some other things going on there, too. There's some interesting evolutionary things.
Well, then hang on to that thought, and we'll get back to that coming in just a second. The other evolutionary thoughts why we love certain animals, and we'll talk more about which ones we hate. Why do we hate certain animals? And then coming up, why do we eat the ones we eat? The book is Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Dr. Hal Herzog, an anthrozoologist on this subject, coming up. And then in hour three, we'll talk to our friend James Childs about what's going on, even as we speak, the extraction of those Chilean miners and a very interesting kind of moral, logical dilemma that's facing them, and open lines coming up too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So I think earlier I said thank you to Ed Reese, but I got his last name wrong. It's Ed Reese Jenkins, who's producing the show from this end in New York City, where I'm live from the Premier Radio Network's studios on Coast to Coast AM. And I'll be here tomorrow night, too. And tomorrow night on Coast to Coast, looking forward to this new book. It's called Holy Ghosts. But hear the author out on this. He's the religion section of Doubleday Books. He's the editor of Doubleday Religions Books. And he's writing this book from his own personal experience of having grown up in a house that his mother said was haunted. Now, he had heard things and experienced things, but he kind of thought his mom was crazy when it came to the whole ghost deal. Just kind of blew it off. But later on in life, he should come to a place where he would move back into the home in which he grew, and he is experiencing all the same ghostly things that his mother did. And that's why the book is called Holy Ghosts, How a Not-So-Good Catholic Boy Became a Believer in Things That Go Bump in the Night. And he will tell us about those bumps coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. This hour, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. We'll talk more about the reasons why we love the ones we do and why we hate the ones we hate. They both have their own emotional logic, but otherwise it's completely irrational, it would seem. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, it's a beautiful fall night here in New York City, but they have put up the annual Rockefeller Center ice skating rink. Tonight was the night they rolled it out. It was weird walking past it, seeing everybody in a Christmas mood. But even there, when we get into the Christmas mood, I'm reminded of something that came out last year, and I'll run this by Hal Herzog, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals, Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. So last year, Hal Herzog, there was a big deal made about IKEA's winter catalog in which they were offering reindeer sausage for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was like, reindeer sausage? How could you do that to the reindeer? And I thought, right, so if they offered it in May, nobody seemed to care. July, doesn't matter. Christmas, no reindeer sausage. Like, this is a reindeer holiday.
I actually ate reindeer. I ate reindeer a couple months ago, actually, believe it or not. It's funny you mentioned that. It actually tasted quite good.
Did anybody give you that thing where they attach the significance of, you know, Rudolph or anything to the reindeer? Was there anything?
No, I was in Sweden, actually, and it was just in a restaurant, and I saw it in the restaurant, and I thought, oh, am I going to order this or not? And then I just couldn't pass it up.
It was actually
quite good, yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me one bit. Well, so that goes back, though, to the ones we love, and some we love, some we hate, some we eat. And I think they reflect back to us something about us. So we would be less inclined to eat a reindeer because of the cuteness of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Absolutely.
Not a problem they're facing in Sweden, obviously. They're not crippled by that problem. So, but what else? What do you mention? There's sort of a complex emotional history to us, evolutionarily speaking, with dogs and cats and animals.
Well, let me mention there's a couple of things. One of the it's a great example of both biology and culture. We fall in love with some animals because they're just absolutely adorably cute. Puppies, kittens, baby seals fit into this category, and they're cute in part because they have these giant eyes and soft features. And ethologists call these baby releasers. They bring out our parental instincts. And we treat them. I've got slides that I show sometimes when I give talks, and I can guarantee people in the room, especially women, will go, oh, and there are always slides of puppies and kittens and things like that. So that's one reason why we do that. The thing about dogs that's interesting is dogs are the first domestic animal, and we've been living with them somewhere between 14 and 40,000 years ago. It's not quite sure how long ago that is. But the thing is that dogs and humans have sort of co-evolved, and they have essentially developed the ability to read human faces in ways that no other animals can. And they will actually imitate human behavior to an amazing degree. For example, when people yawn, their dogs are likely to yawn. And so they can look in our faces, and they know something about what's going on in our heads to a degree that even chimpanzees can't do.
You know, I'm willing to accept that because I look just for this is oh, sounds awful. So I look at my my dog Jacula, and I will make a face at him just for giggles. I look at him very sternly, and he immediately looks worried. And I think, wow, that just and there's never a time when that doesn't work. If I wrinkle my brow at him and just look at him and give him a look, oh, he just right away he's sort of in this defensive position of what did I do? I didn't do anything.
Yeah, let me tell you something about that. That's the so-called guilty dog look.
Yeah.
There's a woman at Columbia that's just done a really great study of dogs on that, and the question is, does your dog give you that look because it really knows it's done something wrong, or because it's picking up the cues from you? And she did these. The spirit was a little bit cruel in a way, because what she did was she had dogs. The owner would tell the dog to do something and then leave the room. And the dog had to sit in front of a treat but not eat it. And then what the researcher did was when the owner came back, she would incorrectly tell the owner that the dog had violated the rule or not. And what she found out was that the dogs responded, whether or not the dog ate the treat did not really make the difference in the guilty dog look. It was what the owner thought. So you're exactly right. You're a very astute observer of dog behavior. It's your dog picking up on you, when it poops on
right.
the rug, rather
okay,
than
but,
knowing that it pooped on the rug.
Okay, but sometimes, like I said, I just throw him that look just for giggles. I just trying to see whether what he'll do, and he always follows it. Now, I'll have to say other times, and my dog is generally pretty good, but, I'll come home and I'll come into the kitchen and I'll just say hi, and he looks immediately guilty. He's got he's dropping his shoulders down. He may try to leave the room really quick, and that's my cue that I know that he's done something wrong. And it doesn't have to be anything like going to the bathroom in the house. He can often... my dog has this thing, he just hates stuffed animals. And if he can ever get out, if I have him, say, just in the kitchen, we have a nice little dog bed in the kitchen, and if I leave him in the kitchen while I'm gone, and for some reason he can get out, the boys leave the door open or something, he'll immediately go up to one of their rooms, find a stuffed animal, rip its throat out, empty it of all stuffing, leave it right there, eviscerated, leave it right there on the floor, then go back down to the kitchen. And when I walk in, he gives me a look like, I'm so sorry I had to do it. And then we have to walk around the house to find out what he did.
To look at what he
yeah.
did.
But he's telling us. He's like copping to something. And we're like, okay, what'd you do? And he's just like laying there like, I didn't do anything. But we know because of how he acts. And I don't think we're imagining that. I don't know. If he acted like nothing was wrong, I wouldn't know anything was wrong.
Well, I don't know what to say about that. Yeah, maybe your dog's neurotic.
Well, that's entirely possible. All right, so the some that we love, and again, to whatever degree they reflect something back to us, dogs, because they can mimic our expressions. They try to tune into our emotional frequency, whatever.
Yeah.
Why do we hate the ones we hate?
That's sort of the same question. It's a mixture of biology and culture. I think, for example, snakes, I think there's pretty good evidence now that we either, not everybody, I like snakes, and I've done a lot of research on snakes, but most human beings have an aversion to snakes. Primates have an almost universal aversion to snakes. And it's either instinctive, hardwired, or at least it's very easy to learn. Fear of snakes is a very easy thing to do. And there's some recent data showing that even human infants, very, very young, can spot snakes before they can spot other creatures.
I saw that. That was an interesting story in the book about how human beings who were so young or so isolated they had never even so much as seen a picture of a snake.
That's right.
Could pick a snake out of a picture.
Yeah, it was really, really pretty amazing. And I think there's other reasons why we dislike some animals. One reason is, for example, if they're really ugly. So, for example, one of the I think a real interesting creature is the giant Chinese salamander, which is a 6-foot brown hunk of slime. And it's absolutely repulsive looking. It's got beady little eyes. But it's very endangered. And you compare people's responses to that compared, for example, to an animal that's not endangered, which is baby seals. You know, there's adorable white baby seals that are clubbed to death on the Canadian ice floes. And people get really bent out of shape about the baby seals, but not the panda. And there was actually a study done in Europe a couple of years ago where they asked people, you know, how much they'd be willing to pay to save endangered species. And it turns out the biggest predictor was the size of the creature's eyes.
Right. You know, that's not terribly surprising to me on the eye thing, but why do you think that's true, that it's the size of the eyes that matter?
I think it's because human infants have great big eyes. I think because infants generally have big eyes and that they just hook our parental instincts. However, that being said, there are some cultures where people look at a puppy and where we see something that's absolutely adorable, they see lunch. There's about 25 million dogs and cats eaten in Asia each year. And so that those creatures that we consider pets over here, we'd never consider eating. In some cultures,
I wonder whether wide eyes express, no matter whether it's an adult human or a child, wide eyes express vulnerability.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's absolutely true.
Yeah, and we see somebody with wide eyes and we think, oh, they need help.
That's absolutely true. And you're absolutely right. And what happens is that's a terrific observation. That part of that sympathetic nervous system stuff, when you get that flight or fight syndrome, one of the symptoms is a dilation of the eyes. You're absolutely right.
We call that headlights. Get your
You're in the headlights look, yeah.
Yeah, you get that. Well, even your eyes are like that high beams look of like, yikes. Yeah. So but you mentioned like the 6-foot, you know, chunk of slime, that Chinese salamander, which, by the way, it's nice to have a new analogy to describe my wife's previous boyfriend. that salamander, you know, no one's going to be sending any money to save the salamander, but the salamander may be just as essential or even more to the ecosystem as the panda bear.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, they both live in the same areas. And furthermore, that salamander is in some ways more unique than the panda. Well, they're both unique, but that's the largest salamander on Earth.
We had Susan Casey on the show last week. She's the author of a book called The Wave. It just came out.
I heard that show. I was listening to that show.
Oh, were you?
Great. I was.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm so glad to hear you like that. And she was talking a little bit about sharks. And so I threw in the next day, I was doing the annual blessing of the animals service at my church. And right. We made a point, the priest and I, to throw in sharks at a couple of key parts in the service. And it kept, I looked at one parishioner who threw a look up when we're naming all of these animals, we throw in sharks. And they thought, whoa, what are we doing blessing sharks? And I think that there's something to that, though, that without sharks, for example, there wouldn't be any of the other cuter species like dolphins or other things. You know, all the whole ecosystem would fall apart without sharks in the ocean. But I think it has something to do, again, with the eyes, and it has something to do with the fact of what kind of face the animal has. And you write about that a bit in Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat. A lot of it has to do with whether the animal has a face to some people.
Yes, and one of the most interesting things I discovered in writing the book was how many vegetarians eat meat. And it turns out that most self-proclaimed vegetarians actually eat meat, and they actually eat a surprising amount. And when you ask people about that, oftentimes they'll say, I don't eat things that have a face. You say, well, what about that chicken you're eating right now? And they'll say, well, or that fish.
Right.
Well, it doesn't have a face, but
they have a face.
I like chickens, man. I think they have a face.
Right. But what an odd criteria! It doesn't have a face. It doesn't. Of course, it has a face, right? I mean, A fish has a face,
fish
sort of.
A face. And, but what we do is we sort of conveniently construct categories that enable us to use animals in ways that we find intuitively satisfying.
Well, that's the interesting part, then, isn't it? That we create, we construct. These trap doors.
Absolutely.
In our belief systems, so that we always have a way to wiggle out of something. They can be pretty tortured things. Just like I won't eat something that it doesn't have a face. I'll only eat it if it doesn't have a face, even when it has one. And that there are certain other things that people do. Like you mentioned that there are more ex-vegetarians than vegetarians.
A lot more. There's about four times as many ex-vegetarians. Most vegetarians go back to eating meat.
And so a lot of them become vegetarians because they looked at an animal and the animal looked defenseless and they felt bad about, you know, from that point forward, they couldn't eat something's flesh. What's the deciding factor to going back to eating something which at one time looked adorable to them?
Well, the studies that we've done, that there's really three factors. One factor is people have meat cravings. At some point, they will develop cravings for meat. Another factor, and this is actually a bigger factor, is that their health seem to be going downhill. Now, this isn't true of all vegetarians, but it's true of quite a number of the ex-vegetarians. I've talked to some long-time vegetarians, you know, people that have been vegetarians for 15 or 20 years, and they'll say, you know, my health just started going downhill.
Right.
And the other reason is we found social factors, that it was a hassle being a vegetarian, that, you know, they'd go to their friends' houses and, you know, everybody's eating meat. It would become a big deal. Or they had trouble getting the food that they needed to have a good vegetarian diet. But, you know, the bottom line, very few of them had actually changed their – we found it was very few people actually changed their attitudes about the morality of eating animals, but they had started eating animals again.
And even yet, it would make more sense that we eat the animals we hate, but we don't.
We don't. That's a great point. And, for example, let's take why people don't eat dog, people that don't eat dog. Well, in the United States, we don't eat dog because we love them. But in Islamic countries where dogs are despised mostly because the Quran doesn't eat widely of dogs, they don't eat dogs there because they consider them vermin and they consider them garbage eaters and that they have bad habits, which I won't go into. But they're considered to have bad habits. And so they don't eat them because they think dogs are disgusting. We don't eat them because we think that they're so lovable. Fascinating.
Yeah. And so, but when it comes to something like rats, other than, you know, like a food of last resort, we generally don't eat rodents. Even there are some cultures, maybe where you are in Western Carolina, more common for people to eat squirrel or possum or something like that, a raccoon, not out of the question by any means for people to eat that. But generally speaking, as a population, we bring in exterminators to get rid of rats, but we don't say, and make sure you save them in a bag for dinner tonight. We want them gone, period.
Yeah, that's right. And I've actually wondered about that. And I think that the reason for that has to do with the association of rats with garbage. But you know, the bottom line is this, Ian. The bottom line is that what one culture considers food, meats are easily tabooed. And so, for example, in some cultures, you know, eating pig is just absolutely tabooed. But yet, in a neighboring country, they won't be. Or you also see this in India and Pakistan, for example, where in India, you know, eating beef is largely tabooed, but in Pakistan, it's eaten regularly. You know, countries right next to each other.
Right. Or even in, I wonder what's taboo food in Asia? I watch a lot of Andrew Zimmern.
Me too.
The Travel Channel, and so whenever he goes to Asia, they eat anything. I mean, they're like creating bizarre species in labs so they can eat it later on. I mean,
when I was writing the book, I made a list of things that I would never eat, and I had jellyfish on that list. And then I was in a Chinese restaurant in Boston, and they had jellyfish on the menu, and I thought, can I do this? And I ordered the jellyfish and I ate it, and then I had to change that. I had to change that sentence in the book, and I had to put jellyfish in the category of things that I would eat.
Right. Or did you go into one of those torture things of I'll never eat box jellyfish? You like,
yeah, right.
You start getting into complex justification systems.
They,
all right,
they do have a much broader, in Asia, they do have a much broader
palate.
Palate, yes, thank you very much.
Okay, but all right, first of all, when we come back, I got to ask you the question about what did jellyfish taste like? And then, was there actual, did you get like a jelly thing out of it? And then
wasn't like that at all. You know what it was like? It was almost like thick bean sprouts, like alfalfa sprouts or something like that.
Yeah,
it was
that.
More like the tentacle things, and it didn't have much taste, but it had a peppery flavor because I put a pepper sauce in it. It was sort of chilled, by the way.
Sort of chilled. All right. But then we'll get back to the ones we hate. Why do we hate the ones we hate? And then why do we eat the ones we eat? Hal Herzog coming up next on the complex psychological relationship we have with animals on Coast to Coast.